Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Bit great today, isn't it?
I'm here. Welcome. Nescafe Gold at the ready. Pepsi Max. Whatever beverage you happen to have today. Pharaoh, do you have a beverage?
Yes, I do. I have a large Waitrose apple juice by my side.
So we are gathered today to talk about the Book of Revelation of Bible fame, my favorite book of the Bible, Pharaoh, not for any religious reason, but just because it's cool. It is aesthetically pleasing to me. And as the Daria type character I am, Pharaoh, that's good enough for me.
Well, one of the reasons why I suggested it was because I heard you mentioned that you liked the book, and also I think you made reference to, you know, Christ pulling the sword out of his mouth. And again, I think what's interesting about Revelations, it's filled with, you know, this huge array of symbolic, esoteric language and prophecy and interesting stuff that makes it super vivid and interesting to chat about.
Oh, it's just awesome. And like Johnny Cash reads bits of it out on his American Recordings albums, and you know, in fact, there's a, you know, I did the Residence the week before. There's actually a tie-in with the Residence, because they've got an album called Letters from Patmos. Okay,
nice.
And now I didn't cover it on the, because it's a more recent Residence album, but there has been much scholarly debate over the author of Revelation, Pharaoh. I happen to know a little bit about this.
Yes.
And one of the people who is said to be the author is St. John of Patmos, right?
Yes.
Other people include John the Apostle, right?
Yep.
The one of the 13 disciples, right? Is it 12?
There's 12 including Judas, but there's technically 13 because they replaced Judas. So you could say there's 13.
They replaced Judas with who?
Barnabas, I'm going to say. No, I can't remember.
There's an apostle sub. I didn't know that. There was 13 and this Judas just gets, you know, killed basically. He commits suicide or whatever. So anyway, Semiagog may be joining us. But we suspect that he's sleeping. I don't know what time it is over there. I've opened the entropy. Mr. D is literally painting as we speak. He can't make it because he's painting and he's got a deadline or something. So, I mean, that's a pretty good reason not to be here.
I mean, he's actually making art.
He's literally making art as we speak. So we can't... Yeah, Judas left the band due to creative differences. So anyway, the three touted authors for Revelation are John the Apostle of, you know, Jesus and the disciples fame, that John, okay? John the Gospel, you know, the author of the Book of John, okay?
Yes.
And John of Patmos, some dude who lived like 200 years later. And... scholars have disagreed with this over time, but I believe the settled science by the truth regime, so to speak, is that it was John of Patmos, not the other two Johns. Is that right?
Yeah, well, interestingly, in church traditions, it is actually John the Evangelist or John the Apostle who is considered to be the writer. But I think it's like textual differences in the writing. Like some of the timelines and stuff don't necessarily make sense. So it's a bit of a mystery, but it's obviously the book was certainly canonicalized as part of the kind of choosing of the book, so it's kind of been fully approved.
When I looked into this and cast my literary eye over Revelation and the other books of the Bible,
yes,
I actually had a different theory, which was that basically the same person who wrote this wrote one of the books of the Old Testament, which has got very similar language. Was it Ezekiel? There's one, or was it Book of Daniel, maybe? There's one of the books which is very, very similar with, you know, with the blood and the thrones and the kind of, this kind of really epic poetic language. I think it's either Ezekiel or Daniel that has got that similar feel to it. And it led me to suspect that the same hand was at play. Seemed like a very similar kind of, you know, inflections. But then that could be as a result of the King James translation, of course, which could have just been the same translator, you know.
Exactly. I mean, they had a team of translators working together. Like, obviously, the Old Testament's written in Hebrew. I mean, I doubt that that's true because obviously they've got things like the Septuagint, which is like a version of the Torah, which is the kind of early books of the Bible. Well, they got copies of it before Revelation was written. So I'm not sure about that. However, I would say that there is kind of references to Revelation in the Old Testament as well. So we treat Revelation as this kind of totally individual book in the Bible, but there's references in Daniel, like you said. So they actually Daniel has a vision of the beast, who's a figure that we'll see later. But also interestingly, in Ezekiel and Isaiah as well, there's references to Revelation. In Isaiah, they talk about the war in heaven, and that's where Lucifer is referred to as Morning Star, which is one of his names.
If Hollywood were worth their salt, Revelation would have been like a blockbuster movie by now. It should be just an epic movie. But where's it? Like, has it been closed down with Christian groups, or is it just because of the people who run Hollywood, or what? I mean,
I think that's a really interesting thing. And one thing I noticed when looking, trying to find artists who covered Revelation, is that I think it appeals to certain mindsets and at certain times. So there's a huge amount of medieval art on Revelation, specifically from about 1200 to 1600. It's in almost every single manuscript of the Bible. There's loads of frescoes in different churches, etc., in stained glass. And then basically nothing comes along until really the Romantic period again. And from kind of like the 1750s up until 1900s, there's another like wave of Revelation content. So again, Blake, John Martin we'll be seeing as well, and a couple of other smaller minor guys. So I think it must reflect the mindset and the temperament of the people in the time as well. You know, obviously the medieval guys are, you know, I don't want to use the word superstitious because I think that's a bit a bit mean, but you know, they'd see a comet and have a bit of a freak out, wouldn't they? So I think it depends on the people at the time, basically.
Yeah, now just one last. I did see someone in the chat mention that Ezekiel, Daniel, and Revelation are all considered apocalyptic books. I just want to mention I think you've got some pictures of St. John here, don't you? So let me just get them up. But one of the things, because I, you know, sometimes you do kind of go on like go down certain rabbit holes. Mm-hmm. This was a rabbit hole I went down once, and I spent, you know, have you ever had those evenings where you kind of start looking at something and before you know it, 6 a.m. and you're still kind of reading type thing
all probably the time.
Well, I did this one evening on this question, because I was like, this is weird. How can you have a major book of the Bible, how can you have a book of the Bible which has got three different possible authors? And how could it be that now they consider it to be this John of Patmos, when, as you said, for centuries they thought it was John the Evangelist or John the or John the Apostle, right? And the answer that a lot of scholars have come up with is that it couldn't be the other two Johns, because it was written 200 years later. So it's literally impossible, because nobody lives to be 200 years old. And in fact, and this could just be like secular scholars trying to like, you know, denigrate the religion or whatever, but it seemed like for a good while in the scholarship, the theory was that none of these guys John the Apostle is separate, is like a character in the Bible, so leave him aside. But the idea was that John the Gospel, which was actually written, you know, the Gospel of John was written after the other three books. You know,
it's the latest one. It's, you know, it's often referred to as the Gnostic Gospel. It's got references to both Matthew and Mark, some of the stories from there, basically. So it's considered to be like the last one. So,
but the idea was, and again, I don't know, I'm not up on the cutting edge. This is just what I learned that night. The idea was is that the John the Gospel wasn't just one guy. It was probably like about 200 different writers all working on this together. And then, like, it couldn't have been him. It couldn't have been that group, because the Revelation was written even later. And even John of Patmos may have been more than one person. That, in fact, any of the writers of the Bible could have just been like almost like, you know, working groups rather than a single author. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, there has been a lot of, let's just say, dissection of authorship of the Bible. I mean, I've seen some stuff, a lot of the stuff on Wikipedia. What's interesting is they definitely push the secular research that's been done into it, as opposed to from the evangelical or Catholic scholarship, which is excellent. I mean, I couldn't say I know much more than you, but I'm relatively skeptical of these kind of like hundreds of writers. When you kind of see the tone and the kind of the language they use, I feel like there's a definite single writer for Revelation. But
I feel the same. And it's a very distinctive style. And as I said, I thought the same style was in those earlier books, Daniel or Ezekiel. I can't remember quite which one, but I was, you know, when I look back over, it was like, really does seem like the same hand. And then you read John, i.e. John, I don't think the book of John was written by the same author as this, because, I mean, excuse my language, Pharaoh, but Book of John's quite gay, and this is quite like based.
I don't know about that. It's, you know, it's a definite. It's interesting because, again, we describe it as it's often described as the Gnostic Gospel. It's less about the kind of physicalities and more about the spirituality. So again, obviously John starts with talking about the Logos, which is a stand-in for Jesus, which is a stand-in for the Word of God. So this idea of like the spiritual nature of Jesus, while someone like Luke lays out the kind of entire like timeline and life and genealogy of Jesus instead. So it's a different emphasis, but there is a very different tone, I would say, in the book. This is much more matter of fact, and also the stuff that goes on in here is, some of it is pretty disturbing if you read it, and hopefully I'm hoping with some of the art that we'll see, it will kind of bring some of those passages to life.
Yeah, and I wasn't trying to offend any Christians when I said that, by the way. I was just being facetious, you know, as the perpetual Daria that I am. Okay, so let's have a look then. So these are some questions on the authorship.
Yeah, we can skip that. We talked about that already. But
we talked about this, yeah.
So I managed to find a couple of pictures let me just go through this a second. So this is the full layout of what goes on. So people may have heard about different things, but I wanted a quick two-slide idea of what happens. So in each chapter, I've kind of laid out what goes on. So it kind of starts off with, there's an introduction, and it starts off with a vision of the Son of Man, which is another name for Jesus. It then goes, the writer then goes on to talk about a whole lot of different churches. And basically, chapters 2 and 3 are pretty average. But then it comes up to chapter 4, where he sees the throne room of heaven and kind of God surrounded by all these kind of elders and the four creatures. Then finally, the Lamb takes the scroll. So we often talk about the kind of seven seals. Well, what are the seals sealing? Well, they're sealing a gigantic scroll which descends down from heaven. There are 6 seals that they go through. Then
That reminds me, Pharaoh, that was my way into this, into loving Revelation in the first place, was the Ingmar Bergman film, The Seventh Seal, where a knight plays chess with death, of course.
Yes, yes.
And in the dying moments of that film, they're all kind of dancing in silhouette over this kind of mountain, following death, because everybody must die, right? Mm. And they've got like bits of revelation being, just being recited, obviously in Swedish, because it's a Swedish film, but it's so cool, that ending of Seventh Seal. I was like, oh, did Bergman, like, what is that? Because, you know, I was quite young. I was like, that is like really good poetry. I want to find out where it's from. And obviously it was from Revelation, and it got me into this. So that was kind of the genesis, if you want, of my Revelation love. Anyway, carry on.
Interesting. So basically they end up having the seven seals, and then you may not be familiar, but it then goes on to the seven trumpets instead. So we've all heard of the seven seals, but he's heard of the seven trumpets. Midway through this, it's a really random moment. The eight on chapter 10, an angel gives the writer a scroll, and the writer eats the scroll. It's just a random moment. Then there's another little interlude. Then there's the seventh trumpet. And then if you go to the next slide, then there's another weird interlude, which is the woman, the child, and the dragon. So this is the first time we've kind of see Satan in the form of the red dragon. Then there's the war in heaven, which is another quite popular topic. There's the beasts being summoned from the sea and the earth. Then there's the famous the mark of the beast, the 666.
That's what I love about Revelation. It's just fucking mental. It's like, oh, yeah, there's a dragon, and now there's a, you know, there's a ten-headed beast that's going to come, you know. Anyway, carry on.
Then, interestingly, again, people may have heard of the trumpets, but who's heard of the seven bowls? It's otherwise known as, in some translations, it's known as the vials, seven vials. But there's kind of like seven, it's kind of like the third round of seven there. And then, of course, there's Babylon. And again, this is where your kind of Rastas get all the kind of Babylon references from, basically, the whore of Babylon, which is pretty cool. Then there's the final battle, and then actual judgment day, and then the kind of the wrap up. So that is the rough story. We don't have time to do everything, so I've just kind of taken the juiciest bits from Revelation and where there's the most art. But if you click on again, I've got some pictures of some interpretations of what John is. So this is actually from the Getty Apocalypse. So interestingly, there was a manuscript. It was thought to be written in London. You can see it's in around the 1250s. If you look at the titles, I've included the date and the name of the author of every single
1255
one.
Getty Apocalypse.
And this is, I'm just going to call him John anyway, just because, just for the sake of this. And this is John being dropped off on Patmos here. And I sort of love this, because if you can zoom in on some of the faces of the knights, again, this is coming out of the tradition that it's John the Evangelist writing this. And apparently he annoyed one of the Roman emperors. And so he was basically exiled to the island of Patmos. And that's where he had the visions.
Is this
and
John here? Progress.
That's John here, and you can tell him it's because he's got his halo, which is typically the mark of a saint. And then you can
see Joe Biden in 2021. Anyway, carry on.
I just love some of the expressions. But just interestingly, from an artistic perspective, with a lot of the medieval art, I'm sure what Dee loves to point out is the lack of perspective. So if you just go out a second, notice that, there is no realism here. John has been placed on an island which looks about 1 meter by 2 meters wide, but it's also flat. You know, they haven't tried to show what the island looks naturally. You can see the entire island thrown up in your face from the background. So again, that's just some of the medieval total lack of perspective,
It wouldn't have, if you had not pointed that out, it would not have occurred to me that is the island. I just thought it was just kind of background. I didn't realize he was standing on an island. Yeah. I mean, there's a few other things to mention. Dishonest nose, dishonest chin. Imbecile, this guy here. Whereas John, very honest. Honest features, honest eyes, etc. So at least they included those details.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yep.
Now, if we click across, we've got something a little bit more realism for you. This is it's from a group known as the Flemish Primitives, a guy called Hans Memling. done in 1479. And if this is kind of like during this kind of late medieval period, you know, it's really the Renaissance, really. You have this kind of wave of Flemish Gothic art. You may have heard of Hieronymus Bosch and Bruegel, mm-hmm. and we'll see some of their stuff later. But Memling's another one of these guys. And what I love about this, that you've got John at the bottom here, and then you can see the revelation occurring in the sky. In the background, you've got all of these little vignettes of what's to come. The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. There, you can see in the front.
So badass.
Four
Horsemen.
What I love is he's almost kind of been seeing this vision as through a portal of like a rainbow portal. And what's interesting, they kind of recognise that a rainbow is circular. I don't know if you knew this, but if you kind of look at a whole rainbow, it is totally circular in nature.
I didn't know that. I thought it was a semicircle.
Yeah, it's only because it's sort of it's so big, it's on the ground.
Hold on. Speaking of the Mark of the Beast, I can hear Semi-Agog in the background. Hello, Semi-Agog.
Hello, am I audible?
Yeah, we can hear you. Yep.
Fantastic. For some reason, I got the time difference screwed up. I thought we had a four-hour difference between where I was. Maybe something changed with the time zone, or perhaps I'm just inept. In any case, my apologies, gentlemen. I actually look forward to participating in these things. How are you both?
Good, yeah. We're just talking about the extreme coolness of the Book of Revelation. I mean, I forgot to mention that, you know, my way in was the Seventh Seal, but another one of my loves, Pharaoh, and maybe I'll do a deeper story on this one day, is 1930s Delta Blues, right? Mm. Well, Delta Blues is full of stuff from Revelation. In fact, there's a whole song that goes, John the Revelator, who's that riding? Yeah. John the Revelator. They're always talking about stuff from this book. So, and then, of course, the Johnny Cash as well is full of Revelation stuff. So that was another kind of reinforcement of my Revelation love. And this is John the Revelator right here.
Yeah.
Yes, when the man comes around.
Yeah, when the man comes around, exactly. I'm getting a little bit of echo, I think, from somebody. Is it from you, Sammy? Or maybe. All right, tell me more about this, Pharaoh. Sorry.
But just in terms of like thinking about art history here, we've gone from 1250, where everything's kind of flat, lack of perspective, to the proper Renaissance here. And look, they've tried to show this new level of realism. And what you'll see in this kind of Northern Renaissance art is a kind of freakish level of realism. Everything, they've really tried to show how real things are, but they've also got this kind of still medieval esoteric ways of thinking about reality. So again, the vision in their mind is literally a portal to heaven. You've got to understand that I'm not a medieval expert. I'm sure Semi-Agog can say more than me, but the idea that heaven isn't just above us, it's like almost like an interdimension that's around us. And so that's like a portal to heaven itself. You've got to realize that the Greek word for the Book of Revelations is, of course, the apocalypse. And the apocalypse translated actually means unveiling. So it's kind of like we're lifting the veil on reality. And that's what's happening in this Memling painting here. He's lifting the reality and revealing God, which is kind of almost behind the scenes.
And there's an interesting parallel with in Tibetan art they have, and perhaps in some areas of India as well, but I'm sure in Tibet they have what's called a tanka. And these are painted pieces of cloth that that represent Buddhist saints, things associated sometimes with magic, Buddhist tantra. And one of the things that you'll commonly see is a figure that's seated in a lotus position, and they will have a circle behind them that is much like a Western halo, except it's extended to be a bit larger. So, you know, you'll see that it will extend, you know, over more of their body rather than just in these neat sort of arrangements you see in Western art with the head, you know, with the halo as a ring behind it. But they form a perfect circle and they show a world behind them. And depending on how the tanka is laid out, that perfect circle in the rear of the figure revealing a world that relates to the the tanka, which is kind of like a kind of mandala for a person or a saint. And in some cases, directly a mandala, you know, like showing the world mountain or whatever, Meru or something like this. It reveals in the same way that you see the perfect circular rainbow, a world within. In some sense, it can be thought of as showing the interior world of the saint who is depicted in the tanka. So I'm not suggesting that here we have any like monogenesis and direct influence coming out of Tibet to Christian art in the West. I think it's perhaps more revealing that we have a parallel that maybe says something more about the nature of the inner world and what can be revealed about it.
Yeah, no, that's kind of the move that someone like Evola makes all the time, isn't it? He's always looking like, oh, this is obviously revealing some aspect of some universal truth that cuts across cultures type thing. But I'm just interested here about identifying some of the, like, who is this figure in the back? Is that, to me, that just looks like Gulliver's Travels. That, but what the hell's going on back there? Who is this?
This is we'll get to there eventually.
At the end, I want to come back to this painting to be able to identify. I mean, I'm guessing these are the four horsemen here.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
based bow play there from this guy. I mean, I recognize this beastie here. But we'll come back.
I think that's Death and the pale horse, and Death rides behind him, doesn't it? So that's Death itself personified. You've got the meteor known as Wormwood, which crashes down, and the ship's being destroyed. Anyway, yeah, we could keep
making the water bitter. Yeah.
Yes. That's another Residents album, by the way, Wormwood. Anyway, let's carry on. Okay, here's another one.
So this is a little bit further on, 1618. So Velazquez, who's obviously part of the Spanish court. So this is kind of like, even though, again, it's only a couple of hundred years difference, we've now got a totally different style of art. What I love about this is that this is kind of, I describe him as kind of like Mexican. This is Latino John the Evangelist. Is quite
we was evangelists.
We was evangelists. But I guess this is kind of reminiscent of kind of Caravaggio, this kind of focus on light and darkness, where again all of that kind of like hyperrealism of the Northern Renaissance has made way for new classical forms. And again, this kind of, you can see the lightness of John there and the back and the darkness of the backgrounds. But
I love this Caravaggio style. I think Caravaggio is my favorite of the, you know, I know he's kind of later in the Renaissance, but I always, whenever I've gone to galleries, this is the, I like this style the most, rather than the earlier Renaissance style of likes of Raphael, etc. I always like the Caravaggio or the Caravaggio influence type painters like this. Shall we carry on?
Yeah. I think if we go to the first, so that's it for kind of an introduction to John. So the first section I've got is the vision of the Son of Man. So I have the full verse. We don't need to read through the whole thing.
Come on, let's do it. Okay. We're gonna take a verse each, right? I'll start. Semigog will go next, and then I'll do the vision of the Son of Man. Semigog will do the next one, and then we'll just do. And Pharaoh can do the one after that. All right, you're ready for this? I'm gonna try to not do a Johnny Cash impression. All right, hold on. When I turned to see the voice that spoke with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the midst of the seven lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the feet and girded about the chest with a golden band. His head and hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes like a flame of fire. His feet were like fine brass, as if refined in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. He had in his right hand seven stars, magic missile. Out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was like the sun shining in its strength. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
That's very good. What's interesting, just even before we look at the pictures, I mean, that's pretty, there's nothing too crazy apart from the feet, which has always baffled me. Now, I guess when we're looking at this, this is highly symbolic language. Again, colors and materials have certain meanings, And again, like, yeah, like the sun shining its strength, you know, there's the kind of power, the brightness, the sun as light bringer, et cetera, et cetera. But again, I don't by any means know everything. So if anyone in chat knows why, or the reference to brass feet are, I'd be definitely interested. But if we click on.
I'm afraid, again, due to my age and temperament, all I can think of is a D&D kind of mage or priest here. Like, I mean, in his right hand was seven stars, magic missile. You know, he's cast some sort of iron flesh type spell. You know, that's why his feet are.
It's probably because D&D have got their ideas from some of these medieval manuscripts, no doubt. I'm sure when you see the first image, it will be very similar to.
But we have to bear in mind that magic missile is, of course, arrows, not stars. The feet of brass, there may be something going on there with the idea of the change in color, because the rest of it's all pure white, and then it changes color as it gets close to the ground. But you have to imagine also the weight of brass and the sound that brass feet would make clumping along in the world on some sort of celestial figure. So, you know, perhaps that's a clue.
That's cool. Okay, so this is, it's from York Minster. So if those don't know, York Cathedral has an entire window of all of the scenes of Revelation in it. And I've just, again, chosen some of the best bits. But made in 1408, so again, you know, relatively late into the kind of medieval period, early Renaissance. And you can see here, you've got the Son of Man literally seated on an altar. There's the seven lampstands or seven candles, as it's often shown behind him. You can see the stars sort of intermingled with the lampstands on the left. They've got him literally, the mouth is sort of like, like sort of popped on over his mouth. Yeah. I mean, you can't see the brass feet. And then you've got John the Evangelist in the front here, kind of bowing down before this vision. But again, look at the perspective on the altar. It's kind of all higgledy-piggledy. It's not that accurate. But it's obviously very difficult to kind of represent things in stained glass at the same time. So it's all about the kind of colours they use.
Cool. What is it about the number seven? I know you're into some of this type of stuff, semi-gog. Like the number seven occurs a lot in this book. And we can see it here with the seven stars and the seven, what are they, candles, do you say?
It's seven lamps, it's known as, or again, the seven candlesticks. It could also be translated as.
Yeah, there's seven letters warning against, you know, sent out to the various congregations in the beginning, then seven seals on a heavenly scroll, then seven trumpets of warning, then seven bolts of God's final wrath. So yeah, this thing is riddled with sevens. As best I can tell, I mean, there's quite a bit of 12 in there too. Oddly enough, that 7 and 12 is reflected later in our diachronic and chromatic scales, which brings us to the idea of the music of the spheres, but laterally, not in any historical sense. But really, I think it has to do with the planets. Seven planets in the Middle East. You know, the Earth and the Moon were both considered to be planets, as well as the other wandering stars in the sky. In the Ptolemaic or more ancient conception, Earth was at the center. And you find that seven is reflected in our days of the week, which really does seem to go back to the Middle East. You know, the Romans had a week of a different length of days. So, you know, what we have is vestiges with, like, you know, Sunday, Monday, sun and moon. So I believe what we probably see here is the idea of a celestial order imposed on Earth that is simultaneously the movement of the planets and this broader scheme, as well as how the affairs of men are organized in cycles. And the important thing to underline here is that they do form a cycle, because the week comes round yet again as this order of the moving spheres is recapitulated in manifestation, if I may say so. So yeah, I think it's cosmic order that has nested within it the order of manifestation in the material world, in cycles. And this, as sort of the pure seven, strikes me as kind of a perfect grand cycle rather than that which is reflected in the week.
I know the number 12 is quite big in Islam. specifically the Shia Islam, are they known as the Twelvers? The Twelve
Imams. Don't forget you've got the Seveners and the Fivers.
Right, yeah.
The number of Imams, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But I think the Shias are all about the 12, right?
In Iran today, yeah, are 12ers. But like the Aga Khan's people were like 7ers, and the ones in Yemen are 5ers. So it has to do with the number of Imams, but you're quite right to pull that out. That idea of the number of the Imams has to do with cosmic cycles as well. You know, some Imams being hidden, a secret order being a part of all of that. It's the same sort of numerological thinking, and particularly with the heterodox Shiites, you have this same kind of number symbolism.
And of course, 12 disciples.
That has to do. I'm sorry.
Well, who apparently was subbed, according to Pharaoh. I'd never hear that before. That there were 12 disciples. Judas gets yeeted and then gets replaced. I didn't know that. I always thought they were 13, and then it was just 12 after Judas died. I didn't know it was always 12.
That also has a celestial thing, because 12 is sort of like a reflection of 60. 12 has the largest number of factors, duodecimal or whatever, so you can divide it the most ways. It's really far, far, far more sensible a number and a basis for a numerical system than the base 10 stuff that we're saddled with today. You know, once upon a time we talked about things like dozens and gross because it's easier to divide that.
In fact this has been in the news this week, Sammy Gog, that apparently certain people at Oxford University want to do away with all imperial measurements and to go to metric only, because imperial measurements are tainted by colonialism, basically, you know, racist measurements. So
dirty commies. But my point that the base 12 really comes out of base 60 sexagesimal, which is the next huge jump up in factors if you choose a base system for reckoning. And of course the base 12 and base 60, which I just linked there, are tied to Babylon and the earliest astrology. So all I'm really trying to do is come around from the other direction and say that the 12 reflects that idea of celestial order as well.
Great. Okay, so let's carry on. Here are more visions of the Son of Man, or what's going on here?
So this is an etching from Albrecht Dürer. So he's a famous German Renaissance artist. I can't remember the exact date of this. I think it'd be like 1470 or something like that. But again, it's a slightly different interpretation. What's interesting about Dürer is he's one of those kind of first, international art stars, because he used the printing press to kind of get his art across the entire country. So, for example, I'm pretty sure he meets up with Titian and also maybe Raphael as well. Again, I correct me if I'm wrong. He basically does a series on Revelations as well. You can see here, this time the lampstands are sort of almost surrounding Jesus. And also you've got the kind of stars more in the hand. That really reminds me of something out of your Dungeons and Dragons or something.
He does look like, you say they're arrows, Semi-Gog, and I know this is a bone of contention with you, but in all of the D&D games I've played, the magic missiles appear more like kind of little kind of almost like little stars that they throw. So to me, that looks like he's about to cast an awesome spell, but there we go. Yeah, I quite like this one. It's cool. Any comments, Semi-Gog?
It has to do with role-playing games versus video games, and you refer to video games, whereas I refer to role-playing games.
Yes. Okay, so let's carry on. I quite like that one. That's it. I mean, that looks more like God the Father to me than Jesus, but a bit unusual to have Jesus kind of looking quite God the Fatherly there.
Well, I mean he would have a beard, the fact he specifically mentioned as the Son of Man is like that's the name that he refers to as himself, and there's Old Testament prophecy around it, so it's definitely Jesus. So that's artistic interpretation, maybe because he's in like an old guy in the clouds.
That's the oldest Jesus I've ever seen. Usually Jesus is younger, you know,
yeah,
because he died at You died at 33, of course. Do they return you to your peak? I've never un- like, what are the rules of heaven? Like, do you get returned to your, like, your peak?
It is a mystery, I'm afraid.
All right, okay. I always like the idea that you kind of get, you know, I don't know, get returned to your physical and mental prime, let's say. You know, so let's say when Marlon Brando died, you know, he's an old fat guy. It'd be Marlon Brando as you see him in, like, Streetcar Named Desire or something, not fat Marlon Brando that would be in heaven. Assuming
is it AA's prime 18 when he first wrote his book? That's like peak.
Yeah, I don't know where my prime would have been. Okay. Semi-Gorg, you're up.
Okay, hopefully, is this echoing? Are we good?
Yeah, we sound good.
All right. Immediately I was in the spirit, and behold, a throne set in heaven, and one sat on the throne. And he who sat there was like a jasper and a sardius stone in appearance. And there was a rainbow around the throne, in appearance like an emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones. And on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white robes. And they had crowns of gold on their heads. And from the throne proceeded lightnings, thunderings, and voices. Seven lamps of fire were burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. Before the throne there was a sea of glass, like crystal, and in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures full of eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion, the second living creature like a calf, the third living creature had a face like a man, and the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle.
So cool. Admit it, everyone. This is amazingly cool.
The four beasts of the apocalypse, yes.
Yes. Yeah, so interestingly, the four beasts later get associated with four gospel writers. So when you typically see in art the four gospel writers, they'll be associated with one of those beasts. So, for example, I believe Luke is the eagle. Mark is the bull. MacArthur is a flying bull. Mark is the lion, because that's like St. Mark's Square in Venice, for example, has a winged lion. So there's a connection between the gospel and those guys. But yeah, let's look at some pictures and you'll be able to see. So again, this is a relatively early one. What I love about this here, I don't know if you can see on the left-hand side first, you've got John the Evangelist, and there's a little peephole. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah, he's looking through.
And he's kind of peeping into this this future. You've got the kind of the rainbow wrapping around God at the center of the throne. On the can you see on the corners, you've got those four creatures. It's very hard to see.
Yeah, but, I can see that. Yeah,
so there's the kind of...
One's got the face, one's got the eagle, one's the lion, and one's the... What was it again? There was another one.
There's a lion, a bull, and an eagle. Yes. Now, their actual descriptions, that they go into more detail, but it's pretty horrific. They're covered in eyes.
I remember that, yeah. Covered in eyes, yeah.
Rather reminds one of Argus, correct?
Yes, yeah, it's interestingly. But that never gets pulled through in the depictions. We always kind of like quite personalize. Also, I think there's references, things like it had the face of a human. And so often people just depict that beast as like a full-on human, but actually it's never described as a full-on human. It just has the face of a human, so who knows what its actual form is. But
in their little quarters down there, doesn't it appear? I mean, I can't see it very clearly on screen here. Maybe I'll make it larger and look. Doesn't it look like they're covered in eyes, particularly on their wings, which looks we're coming straight out of Persian tradition with peacocks?
Yeah, you can see the eyes. Yeah, you can see the eyes on the wings. Yeah, without doubt.
And we've also got the vesica piscis. Did you talk at all about that, Farah? The way it's two interlocked circles and it's sort of a place between worlds. Well, I mean, I'm just remembering. You may know better than I. Let me see if I can pull it up. It just shows a math. It's basically a frame for Christ consistently in illuminated manuscripts, medieval art, and much later. I'm not an expert on the art background the way Pharaoh is, so I can't say much about it other than obviously it's the shape that is formed by the intersection of two circles, and Christ embodying the Word made flesh, and God taking the form of man. It seems fitting that he would occupy a geometric figure that is formed by two circles overlapping, sort of like the Venn diagram of the material and the celestial.
So just to be clear, this is the kind of oval thing in the center. The emeralds, yeah.
And was there a reference to 24 kings in this?
So 24 elders.
24 elders, here we go.
Yeah, so there you can see them in the four quarters. And basically the elders then go on to throw their crowns before God, basically in kind of reverence. But I always think that's interesting because it does show that there's hierarchy in heaven. So there you go. We're not all.
There's hierarchy in heaven. There's also the 24 is just a doubling of the 12, as we see with the Egyptian system, where you have the idea of 12 hours of the day and 12 hours of the night. So just tipping my hat there to the fact that that's still pretty much 12 doubled.
Okay, awesome. Do you want to move on?
Yeah.
There's a similar one. This is from the Cloisters Apocalypse, which is a French manuscript, but this is a little bit different. What happens a little bit later in the story is that Jesus, in the form of the Lamb, then approaches the throne, and that's where he's going to receive the scroll. So interestingly, again, Jesus is referred to as the Son of Man, but he's also personified as the Lamb, and the Lamb comes from the kind of sacrifice. So again, his sacrifice on the cross, he's kind of like becoming a sacrifice, like the Old Testament sacrifices. But he's also referred to as the Lion as well, the Lion of Judah. So you've got this interesting duality between the kind of meek, quiet, sacrificial Lamb, so that gets killed, and again the kind of powerful, strong Lion. So
I have to mention this lamb here. I went to a school where this was the symbol of the school, pretty much. This, the lamb with the halo and the little flag there. I'm guessing that is the symbol for St. John, is it?
No, it's Jesus.
But is it used for St. John a lot? Because I've seen this lamb in various places. I went to a pub once as well.
There's loads of lamb and flags.
Yeah, with the lamb and flag, yeah.
I think it's just. He describes himself as a lamb as well in the Gospels, but I think it's mainly associated from Revelation. So maybe that's the connection. But
in which case, the lamb should have its throat cut and have blood pouring all down the front of its chest, because specifically it's described. And that was forced to reread Revelations in preparation for this, and I was like, wow, I forgot that the lamb was all hacked up and as though it had, you know, been laid in sacrifice. It's pretty gory image, which I'm noting doesn't appear so much in the artistic representations, unless it were something like, you know, some Grunwald had approached this topic.
Now, who are these? Are these women on the left here?
No, I think that's just people.
Minions.
You can see the kings, other saints, you would say. You can see the kings, yeah. kings below, and then the animals, and then. But I quite like the throne of that, where again it's literally you've got the rainbow, and then a nice little cushion on the rainbow. It's quite not exactly the most grand throne you could think of, but quite nice as well. But
the violence that has been done to the rainbow over the years. I mean,
well, it's interesting. I always find it interesting that that's the one of the symbols they try and target. You know, it's interesting that again it's got such a strong association with the. God and Christianity.
And I'm also wondering why the evangelical Christians, who, I mean, all of them love the book of Revelations, as I recall anyway, how it is that in their various, you know, their searching of the horizon for signs of the coming apocalypse, how it is that they fail to sort of notice the proliferation of rainbow flags and the attempt to make them a general global flag and this whole business with the apocalypse of St. John.
There's been an interesting wresting away of the rainbow from that group recently, though, in this country, Semigog, because they, during lockdown, they had all of the children in the country, basically, at school, make posters saying, thank you to the NHS. Thank you, NHS. So, I mean, around here, you can walk down the street and basically every other house, any house that's got a kid in school, has got a poster in the window with a rainbow on it saying, thank you, NHS. And I do believe that the LGBT has picked up on the fact the rainbow was being arrested back off them by the NHS now. So
it's interesting. I feel like it's two separate gods trying to trying to wrestle it away from.
Yeah, and it's the Book of Revelation singular. Somebody in the chat is mentioning it. Revelation singular. Book of Revelation. Me. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Let's carry on.
So this is a little bit different. So there is a monastery, a series of a complex of monasteries in on Mount Athos, which is in north. I think it's north of Thessaloniki in Greece, where no women may go. So it's just filled with male Orthodox monks. And within Athos, there is a full hagionomy. I think it's called the hagionomy, or like a full depiction of Revelation in fresco. And so I've put in a few of these pieces. So this is done in 1533 in the Byzantine style, because again they go through a different tradition. Now the first thing you'll notice is that all of the faces have been defaced. That's due to the Turks. It's been Turkified, I'm afraid. But you can see, here if you see the rainbow at the top, the throne. It's interesting to see the different depictions of the four creatures, and then the kings, rather than being in a huddle, are kind of a road below, and they're throwing the crowns before God there.
Two groups of 12.
Now, I do hate to sully this conversation with a carrot pill, but it does appear that Jesus is surrounded by seven carrots.
I think it's actually grapes, and again, the vine represents blood, and the blood represents sacrifice. So,
are they grapes? They look like seven lamps to me.
Oh, is it the lamps? Okay, sorry.
They look like seven carrots to me.
Well, given the way Dee often characterizes carrots, I'm not sure what that imagery in your mind suggests. Yeah.
Please don't meme this with Dee as Dee is a devout is a devout Catholic. He wouldn't appreciate have all of his carrot simps all along the outside. Anyway,
hey, I'm one of those carrot simps, man.
Yeah. This could be you. You could be like John, the carrot evangelist.
John the simp.
Yeah, John the carrot revelator. All right, let's carry on. Oh, what's this one now?
And I think this is the last one. So this is a Blake done in 1803. Now, just a little bit of background to Blake. Blake's obviously a romantic artist. So he's coming off the back of a kind of a wave of classicism. But Blake's pretty crazy. He literally said he saw demons and spiritual figures. But he also did a series in Revelation. This is all done in watercolor, I believe. But Blake is just totally unique in the way that he lays everything out. So we've seen there's some definite figures and definite characters. This is, if you just zoom in at the front here, you've kind of got God on the throne. You've got the beasts sort of surrounding him. So if you look sort of to the left, you can see the kind of head of an eagle. You can see the head of a lion. And there's then their wings sort of wrap around, and you can see all of the eyes up in the air as well, almost kind of like... Yeah. Translucent, and then you should have the king's, like
a peacock's tail coming off of the central figure.
Yeah, and you've got the kings below. But Blake's interesting because he just approaches it from a totally different perspective. He sort of almost abandons all tradition and just comes up with these insane but beautiful pieces. But
I actually saw this in person, I believe, because I went to a Blake exhibit in Oxford a few years back, or five or six years back now. And it was literally all of Blake's paintings in one museum. It was pretty cool to be honest. I like the Blake stuff.
Yeah, so do I. I absolutely find it fascinating. I did not know, apparently many people do, but I only found out recently in the last five or six years. Blake was big into the Moravian Church. With its tradition of sexualizing, in some respects, imagery associated with Christ, the idea of Thomas putting his hand into Christ's wound, There's a strange sort of visionary tradition with the Moravian Church that, at least in his youth, was highly influential on Blake, and he carried apparently some of that highly heterodox view, or some of those attitudes or ideas, I should say, into his later life, and I think it's reflected in much of his art.
Yeah, I mean, he would be considered heretical. I think he was considered heretical at the time. He was also a massive nudist, apparently, and loved to stroll around naked with his wife around his house.
Did he? And there's also another tenuous link back to last week's stream, because if you remember, I was telling you the Residents produced all of their own like packaging and did a lot of stuff in house, like themselves, which is obviously rare in the age of mass production. Blake did this as well, didn't he? He made his own printing, his own printing, his own. And in fact, I think his original books of poems and things, there were only like, you know, a few copies made that he circulated around his friends, and that was it, basically. So you could say that he embodied one idea of the authentic artist. I'm not saying it's the idea, but, you know, he's certainly more, you know, pure, I guess, than more commercial artists, if you want to go down that route. I don't think he ever made any money from his art, right?
Yeah, he lived as most of his life, as I understand it, especially his later life, in abject poverty. And his wife, if I'm not mistaken, someone can correct me in the chat or whatever, I believe his wife helped him with some of the coloring and doing some of the work on that sort of, yes, you know, home press that you just mentioned, AA.
Yeah, so, okay, so let's get on to the next part. We've got a Pharaoh rendition coming up of the Fourth Seal.
So I've put all of these together because it's the Four Horsemen. I unleashed one seal after the other, but I'll make a start. Awesome. Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a white horse who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come and see." Another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one that sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hands, and I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him, and power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth.
Based. That's so cool. Come on, admit it, everyone. This is the best bit of the Bible.
Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers. 100 million angels singing.
Isn't that amazing, though? All right, let's...
Except it drives me crazy because the original Greek, I believe, is that Death's horse is sickly green. And for some reason, it's done up as pale.
So let's have a look at some renditions of this then.
So what I've done is I've organized them. I've got a couple of standalone images, and then I've got a couple where they've put them all together. So this is, again, the Getty Apocalypse. Again, this is Conquest. And he does have a certain resemblance like another Bo Cheese artist. So,
Yeah, great. So which one is this?
The first one. Conquest has the bow.
Okay, Conquest with the bow. All right. Look at this horse. It's kind of scary looking. I don't know if that's deliberately done, but the horse looks quite kind of skeletal and kind of emaciated.
Again, the medieval artist wouldn't really do lots of practice and sketches from real life. So it's always kind of like these like summarized shapes. But yeah, that doesn't. It's not a very real horse at all. But
yeah, if anybody wants to see how they lay it out, like Pharaoh's talking about, there's, what's his name? I'm sure you know him, Pharaoh. It's what is it, Villard de Goncourt or whatever. His his sketchbooks, you can see how the conventionalized forms like Pharaoh is talking about, it's actually a surviving sort of sketch and workbook of a medieval artist. And you can see how they have just sort of these forms that come down based on tradition rather than representation from life. Very, very interesting. I think it's Villard de Goncourt. But yeah, I'm not sure. Someone in the chat, if you may, plug it in there.
So this one's really interesting. So again, this is Conquest from the York Minster. Now, again, what I like about this is they try to jam everything in the picture all at once. So at the top, you can see there's the lamb opening up the seals. Now, instead of a scroll, they're depicting the seal sealing up a book, again, which is kind of like a scroll is a book, basically. But in the kind of medieval traditions, that's how it's been represented. And then the people who are saying, come and see, are the four beasts which surround the throne. So you can see here, this is the lion here, St. Mark's lion, and he's literally got a scroll with come and see on it. And if you can see, and then you can see the evangelist taking a look, and there you've got Morcar on the horse there.
Yeah, there he is on the, you know, so the sacred bow, or the non-sacred bow, because are the riders evil? Are the riders baddies, or are the riders goodies? I can't.
Death gets cast into hell, doesn't he? So I'm not sure. I mean, they kill a lot of people, so I presume they're not great.
Cool. All right, so let's carry on. Here's another rendition of the first rider.
Oh yeah, so this is a bit of romantic art as well. So this is kind of at the time of Blake, but this is an oil painter. This is a French guy who moved across to England. And again, you can see that rather than these kind of strict forms, they've kind of tried to go for naturalism. Everything's kind of floating. You know, they're literally in the clouds, but I quite like this. It's quite different. Also, I love this because you can sort of see the second horse in the background, and he's a real chonky horse. If you can just zoom in on the
and I can see he's going for an overhanded, two-handed sword. You know, massive, massive overhand slash damage there coming.
Yeah,
from him. whereas this one's chipping away the little arrow damage. Although that's a pretty big bow as well. Is this rider a woman?
Well, I think, especially with the classical style during that period, they had a lot of these kind of like youthful boys, shall we say, that had kind of very feminine qualities, and also the way you're doing, you know what, it's a bit of a meme or whatever to have the kind of like the young feminine looking man, basically. But the answer is, I think it's intentionally ambiguous.
Deeply submissive.
All right, let's carry on. Okay, this is the second rider now, yeah?
Yeah, this is war.
This is the horse. This is the sword. So we had the bowman. Now we've got war, who does overhand slash damage, as we saw. Two hands, a massive two-handed sword.
That being a one-handed sword held in one hand with a grip large enough to accommodate a single hand. But he's on a red horse, which represents, probably has a relationship to Mars and red, Aries, you know, some echo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it does kind of hark back to some kind of war god.
Okay, and what's this little monkey beast here?
That's the lion again. I think they don't say what creature says come and see. So again, in different interpretations, it's different creatures, the different of the four that tell the revelator to come and see. So again, that's St. Mark's line.
And you know, these beasties, are they goodies?
Yes, they always kind of help out. Help out God through the whole thing. So,
and there are some traditions where, in addition to the, would you say some of the apostles or the evangelists or whatever, I can't remember, but
the four gospel writers, yeah.
Right. In addition to that, there are traditions where the bird is associated with the air, and the man with, or let me think how it works, that the bull is with earth and the lion is with fire. And anyway, there's a tradition where they're associated with the four elements as well. But I'm sorry, I don't remember all the correspondences.
Can I, what is this kind of walnut whip
effect? It's definitely, it is kind of like a turban. I do wonder whether it's kind of like, Well, again, I think the interesting with the archer again is like you got to understand that in the context of the medieval times, you've had all of the steppe people invading the Huns, the Avars, etc. So and the Mongols. So the classic horse archer is like really the nemesis of conquest. But again, the kind of sword wielders would be your this is at the time of the Crusades. So I wonder if that's meant to be an Arab
Saracens
turban. Saracen turban.
Okay, that's Morgan Freeman from Robin Hood. Right there. Okay, so let's. This is still the second rider in a stained glass now.
Yeah,
this is more of a kind of.
He's better armored. He's like again. War is often shown as like a full-on knight, while conquest is this kind of elusive, flighty figure.
Interesting. Okay. So, but this is more of a thrusting instrument. There could be a lance or something. But yeah. All right. Let's carry on. Now we're on to the third rider.
Yes. So what's interesting about the third rider is that you kind of hear this casual conversation in the background. So obviously he's holding up the weighing scales. And again, the weighing scales would usually be when you're kind of buying food. And so the conversation you hear, it's like a quart of barley for one denarii. So again, I really can't remember the exact exchange ratios, but I think you'd get like one or two denarii for like a week's wage or something like that. So It's kind of like a week's wage for like a handful of a cupful of barley, basically, I think what they're trying to imply. So again, this is famine. You know, he is, you kind of got the unfair weighing of the scales here.
Yeah. Okay. And this is God being tipped off now by, or Jesus being tipped off by Bullface. Okay.
That's the Revelator, but yeah.
Oh, it's John, is it? Sorry,
yeah.
John the Revelator being tipped off by Bullface about famine. Okay, and then tell you what, when John the Revelator woke up, they'd be like, "God, those mushrooms were good," because this is some wacky, bizarre imagery, even by biblical standards, I would say.
I really love the horse here. If you can see, it's kind of like spotted because it's like a plagued horse.
Plagued horse, yeah,
and. He's kind of like, again, look at the lack of perspective where you can look almost into the bowls themselves and the horse is kind of floating in such a weird position. It has this kind of really jarring effect, but it's almost kind of jumping out because it's such a flat image.
Yes. Okay. There's Bullface. Yeah. Starting to spot these characters everywhere now. So let's carry on. Here we go.
And this is death. This is from late Victorian illustrator called Gustave Doré or Dore. And this is the pale rider death here. And you can see that there's Hades following behind him. There is a difference between Hades and Hell, but there's much debate as to what that is and the kind of different states.
My reading around this, I was trying to. Various people seized on the fact that Hades is mentioned here. This is a favorite argument of like people who are kind of anti-Christian. They're like, "What is this Hades cropping up in the Bible?" Type, this is obviously all bollocks type thing. How is that explained within kind of Christian context that Hades crops up in here? Like, why are they?
The New Testament is Koine Greek.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, but isn't Hades also a mythical figure, like before Christianity?
He's a Greek variant of Pluto, right?
Yeah. Yes, but it's referring specifically to the kind of obviously like the underworld. From my understanding, that Hades is kind of a place which isn't it's not a permanent place like Hell is. So people are taken out of Hades. But the word is also, there is a similar word in the Old Testament as well as like a place of darkness as well, because there's obviously no specific mentions of hell in the Old Testament, I believe, as well. So I think, but Hades is used a few times, but again, I think you need a proper theologian to help you with this. But just quite a badass picture. You can see he's got the scythe, which kind of represents kind of time, the reaping as well, and so he's literally kind of reaping lives here.
That brings to mind a thing about the brass feet too. I'd have to look at what the casting temperature for brass is, because it may be that the feet can withstand, you know, from that earlier mention of the figure, you know, with the white hair and the white body and the feet of brass, that there may be something going on there with the casting temperature and the fact that the feet can withstand the heat of what's going on Earth. Anyway, just a odd thought there. Apologies, Pharaoh.
So let's carry on. More death here.
I quite like this one because of the depiction of Hades behind. So again, it's this kind of like animal-like creature turned upside down with the heads of people inside. And then you've got this kind of little imp on top, literally in the clasp of death.
Yeah, that's Satan's, I call it Satan's sales funnel. In the manuscript representations, it's the hell mouth, and there's a huge tradition of the depictions of the hell mouth in miniatures.
I want to say there's a film of Dante's Inferno from like 1920 or something, a really early film. It's very creepy to watch, actually. That has a depiction of this hell mouth in it as well. I seem to remember. This is a very familiar face. This, you see it a lot. How come there's like a little cat face? Look, the mouth is upside down. But if you have a look in his temple, there's a little kind of Cheshire cat in there. Can you see him?
There's a big history of like hiding images within images. So that's, again, if you just kind of Google hilarious manuscript images, there's things like knights lancing snails or riding snails and dog men and just other fanciful ideas, like little doodles put inside there. So it's part of the skill.
I'll just zoom in on that so people can see what I'm talking about. The little cat face in there.
Second face, yeah, he's very devious.
Okay, so it's carrying the eagle doing the tipping off there through the people. Yeah. Like the people that we were talking about. More people action here.
It's just another great hell mouth, I thought, so.
Look at the hell mouth. Look at that. And there's several little faces.
Several faces, I like the kind of melted face there looking up at death. It's horrible.
Can you imagine seeing that in real life? It'd be horrific, wouldn't it? Who's this? Is this the little helper you said again?
I'm not sure what the tradition is from there, but he's kind of like some kind of demon of some kind.
So, yeah, because we see the eagle over in the other corner, so it's not one of the four beasts, certainly.
Yeah.
So we carry on.
This is kind of interesting. So in Angers, there is a depiction of the apocalypse in tapestry form. So they've got over like 60 different tapestries, and this is one of the better ones. This is again death, but death depicted as a skeleton, though, because again we often think of death as a skeleton. Again, we see in the medieval period, it's not. He's a physical character, but he sometimes is. And again, the hellmouth here as like a tower where the demon is stuffing humans inside the top of it.
Yeah. Now, if I was old John the Revelator here, I would cast Turn Undead. Because death is looking pretty scary here, and of course this figure has got a long afterlife. The kind of Grim Reaper character, doesn't it?
You see it in
all sorts of things. I mean, I think in popular culture, you know, we mentioned the Seventh Seal, but the thing I think most people would see it in is in the Christmas Carol, of course. The Ghost of Christmas Future is literally this figure, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's carry on.
Okay, I think that should be. Oh, yeah, this is a slightly. Again, I've put in some of these more modern ones. This is a 19th century symbolist painter called G.F. Watts, who's an English Victorian. And again, this is his depiction of death again. And it's interesting, he's gone back to the kind of medieval style where it's more like a human style creature. But you can see his kind of paint strokes. It's kind of everything's flowing. You get that idea of movement, about dissipation, about this kind of almost dreamlike state that the kind of horse and the rider is. But yeah, quite cool. Right, okay. And now we've got some of them where they're all together. This is from Athos again. So again, this is the kind of Greco-Byzantine depictions. It's quite similar, but I quite liked it as like a nice counter. I think if you zoom in on war, he has a literal cannon on his horse here.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, an actual cannon. He's got in one hand an actual cannon. In the other hand, a sword. Conquest has got his bow, of course. The famine with his little scales, and death is literally he's carrying he's got his scythe. He's got his scythe, and is just terrorizing these minions down here. So, they'd be quite a fearsome four to fight. I'm just trying to think of tactics. Like, what would you do against these four? You'd have to summon them, wouldn't you, Pharaoh?
You just got to run.
Yeah, you got to run.
There's an interesting thing with the cannon as well, because the Ottomans pioneered the use of the cannon more. Of course, you had it in the West, so you can see miniature representations from the 15th century with the use of cannons in the West, especially in some of the French ones. But in the East, the Ottomans carried it forward very quickly. I don't know when this dates. But that's an interesting little thing to point out there, that it gets associated with war. I'd be looking at the other figure to see if it has any Turkish characteristics, given they were renowned bowmen. But the other thing is that cannons in the 16th century, early 16th century, as I recall, at any rate in the 16th century, become a major emblem for like Italian condottieri. So it, in many respects, the cannon at that early phase was sort of like a condensed emblem of war itself, because of its fury, its violence, the explosive sound, the concussion, the fire. It's really a fine emblem. And this is really interesting. I hadn't looked at the Byzantine art like this. You've opened a whole new world to me, Pharaoh.
This is 16th century. So, and he does look quite Italian as well. So maybe it is kind of based on an Italian mercenary. Look at his kind of Renaissance style cap.
I also evil like Venetians trying to impose their Catholicism.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I also like how they have the best depiction of a bow archer there, because obviously the Greeks were in direct contact, like you said, with the Turks, who were expert bow archers. So those guys knew how to draw.
except it doesn't. I'm not. We'd have to look really closely, but we'd have to see if they're drawing with the thumb on the string with a ring rather than the fingers.
I said, what tactics would you use? The chat, as creative as they are, they're like, accuse them of sexual harassment, call them racist, and I'm just imagining a comedy sketch where somebody accuses Death of being a sexist or something. Can you imagine the look on Death's face? Like, what would he do? What would he say or do?
Like out of Monty Python there, where they in the meaning of life, where Death arrives and they're like, how did we all die? And he's like, the salmon mousse. And they're like, yes, I didn't eat the salmon mousse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly that. So let's carry on. Here we go.
So this is quite a famous one. This is, it's interesting. I mentioned about G.F. Watts being a symbolist. There's a definite recurrence of the revelation in that kind of late Victorian period. Venetsov is a Russian. And again, he's got a very Byzantine kind of like background, as he used to be an icon painter and a Byzantine fresco painter in Russian churches. But here he's taken very much more of like a realist approach. You can see how like war has now become like this naked berserker, furious. Yeah. He's not like, look at the horses as well. The horses are just like frenzied and out of control.
Yeah, well look, I mean, he is deathly, he is famine-y, he's kind of, they each reflect the character of the rider. I've noticed that Conquest is always depicted as some sort of king. He's always wearing a crown.
They mentioned that he gets a crown as well. So again, he's obviously some kind of kingly figure. And if you look, sorry,
I was just going to say, coming from the East, it's likely our artist understood that the pale was really supposed to be a sickly greenish, because we can see the death figure has that kind of tone.
Yeah, and coming from the Xennial generation as I do, semi-gog, you know, one up from Gen X, and you know, just a bit older than the pure millennials. I can't help but notice that the character model for Lion-O from the Thundercats is literally that is literally Lion-O.
Oh no!
This is the most cursed culture reference so far on the stream.
That's a lot. I mean,
ever.
You don't believe me, Lion-O from Thundercats. Let me just show you Lion-O.
Brought it down to date is what.
I just have to show you that this is literally Lion-O, though. I mean, look at him. Anyway, yeah, you can look up Lion-O from Thundercats in your own time. It's literally that.
What I love about this is, if you look below, so you've almost got these figures appearing as. Again, symbolic or metaphysical forms. And then if you look below, if you can scroll down a little bit, he's probably furiously getting Lion-O pictures as we speak. But you can see this is the Earth. This is what's going on in the Earth right now. There's a baleful crescent red moon. And you can see, on the left-hand side, you've got a man almost consuming the flesh of another man there. You've got kings killing another kings. On the right-hand side, you've got civilization falling down, those kind of towers, people cowering behind their books. So again, I think it's just a really powerful and
depiction of the end times, basically. Yes, famine, exactly. War, death, yes, conquest, of course. All right, let's carry on then. I love the fact as well, look, conquest up here is rhymed with or mirrored by this king down here. Look, wearing very similar stuff.
That's exactly it. That's a good point. He also almost looks very like he could be wearing the same clothes as well. So that's the kind of there's a symbolic conquest, and then there's because there is all of these people that we're looking at are both can either be symbols or people or a combination of both, and we'll see that in Babylon as well later.
People are saying Sargon is cringer off He-Man. That's a great reference. All right, let's carry on. I really want to see a movie of this now. Okay, so...
So this is going back to Albrecht Dürer again, that German Renaissance artist, and this is his famous depiction of the Four Horsemen here. It's very famous. Interestingly, he really focuses on famine, so you can see famine's right at the center, while conquest and war are sort of pushed across to the right.
There's famine here.
No, that's death, actually.
That's a horrific figure he is.
And oh, I love death because he's got a pitchfork. If you scroll down again, you can see people just being funneled into the Hellmouth there. And also, if you look on, sorry, if you look, go back to the Hellmouth a second, there's some interesting...
there's the Hellmouth, yeah.
Funneled in, yeah. Political tones as well, because that guy's wearing a almost like papal tiara. And again, obviously, Dürer is coming out of Protestant. This is kind of after the kind of... Reformation, so he's kind of making a comment about all you Catholics are going straight into the Hellmouth.
Now these are a bit gnomey, these riders here, but let's have a look. So this is famine.
That's famine. He's actually dressed like a merchant, which is quite interesting. So again, the figure of the merchant is an evil one in Revelation. You'll see their love of Babylon later as well as highlighted, but again
kind of Lutheran overtones, I suppose. And then we've got conquest there.
He reminds me like a Hunnic step rider with that kind of peaked hat. Again, it's not that Germanic really in style.
And then war, of course, with the big sword. He looks kind of wily, look. Kind of a cunning character, conquest in this one.
Yeah, it's physiognomy check.
All right, let's carry on. And that's quite cool. I mean, these are really cool. All of these Four Horsemen stuff I'm into.
Dürer and Volgamut are both great.
Oh, look at this one. What's going on here?
This is great. This is a little known artist. I had to try and find some Americans, and this is a guy called Benjamin West. Now he is from Pennsylvania. He's from 1817, and again he's drawing in the kind of like neoclassical, slightly romantic style. And this is called Death on a Pale Horse again, but it actually features all four of the horsemen. Now, interestingly, Ben became he was the second president of the Royal Academy. So again, he's an American who moved across to England and you know, became good because of that. But if you look on the right-hand side first, you've got those two first horses. You've got Conquest. And War by himself. Yeah. Famine.
I feel like they're a bit of a tag team. It's like, you go short, I'll go long. go in War, I'll cover with a bow. I like that idea. Okay.
And tag team, you just actually dragged iconographic representations of the Book of Revelation over into wrestling. I don't know how you do this.
Now, what is going on? Like, who is this?
You'll get to that in a second. If you look behind those two horses on the left hand side, there's Famine. He's really tucked away.
Where is he?
Up a bit.
Oh, there's Famine there, right?
Super hidden, and then below him are the starving people.
These are the people he's making starve. Okay.
Yeah. Now turn to the left a second, and then go up, and this is Death on a Pale Horse here. Again, he is that sickly green, like you mentioned. He's holding a snake in one hand, but again, look at his kind of furious eyes. His horse rampaging across, but then behind him is Hades. So that's a procession of demons that you're seeing at the top.
Yeah,
various sorts, and you know, you can see how freakishly ghoulish they are. I just love the colours.
This is quite cool, isn't it? Look at that! It's just being that character there. Who's that? That could almost be the. He looks a bit like the painter Pharaoh. Kind of appearing at the back, this character in the back.
what's interesting, I mean, you look at this stuff and you think the guys who must have done this are just totally insane, but they just look like totally normal people. But it's just from, again, like this kind of romantic world's all about the imagination and creativity. But this is the world of death. Now you can see around them the world. Again, the man is literally topsy-turvy across there, people being trampled underfoot. Being savaged by the wild beasts of the land, and you can see, you know, this is like a classical style because everyone's half naked. If you look down to the right there, look at that pose. I mean, that's a ridiculous pose. No one ever sits down with their kind of muscles out like that. But it's just a way to kind of showcase
like a dead baby.
That's pretty. Yeah, I didn't notice that.
This is four. Okay. Yeah, very dramatic style. Wonder what Dee would make of this one.
It puts me in mind, isn't there a horse prominently represented in Guernica? It just suddenly struck me that there might be a whole of this there.
That's a good, yeah.
Is that a pair of doves killing each other down there? Or is that one dove dead, one...
Yeah, I think it's kind of representing the death of love, the death of the loved one. You know, there is a bit of sentimentality in there. And again, the snake has allusions to Satan as well. You can see on the ground, there's loads of snakes and that demonic party.
There we go. Yeah. I reckon modern scholars would have a lot to say about this area up here. They'd say this is the demonization of the ether, they would say. This is like a Middle Eastern guy, and this is a... I'm sure. I mean, I'm not.
Tell us what you see in there. AA.
No, I think I leave it up to the viewer. But I reckon that modern scholars would start like casting aspersions on the artist because of the inclusion of these two figures here.
Yeah.
So. Can you imagine being a psychologist sitting in front of AA with like Rorschach blots and like your notepad is just full of like World Wrestling notes and like Magic Missile? Yeah.
Okay, let's carry on.
Right. Speaking of cursed, I had to put this in there because I found it when Googling the guy. Now, this is a modern interpretation of that painter. Now, if you zoom into the center, who do we see as depicted as Death? Trump on a pale horse here.
Is that Tony Blair in the top
right? I don't know.
That looks like Blair. It really looks like Blair. It's probably not. Is that Putin on one of the horses?
Yeah, I think so again. And then you've got, I think the Obamas there, and then Lady Liberty's dead. So can you see the woman who was lying down below? If you scroll down, you can see that her crown on the bottom right hand side. So Lady Liberty is being crushed and killed there. And then you've got all the kind of like the MAGA babes on the left-hand side following. And then I think Pence, is that Pence on the other horse as well?
Pence, Trump, Putin and some unidentified figure.
Unidentified figure.
And the American flag bikinis are one thing, but who's the woman? Oh, that must be Melania Trump, who's sort of towards the foreground with her ass being displayed.
Yeah, it's Melania. Yeah.
What is going on?
Is that Kamala Harris there?
Probably another noble figure.
I know they left Biden out, interestingly.
I think this was like just as he got in, but it's pretty horrific and it's so badly painted. Obviously,
do you know what? Pharaoh, that is Tony Blair, that is Bush, and that is Blair. Oh my god. Oh, somebody has to. I want that Bush and Blair. I want it kind of. Somebody needs to magnify it, because I could do things with that for my new Tony Blair series. That's hilarious.
Yeah, I found if you search for Benjamin West, pale horse, it came up in the image search results. So there you go.
God.
And does anybody have any sense of what on earth is going on with that polar bear? Is that like a climate death?
Yeah, exactly. The climate's died.
Climate is dying, yeah.
He is literally an explosion.
Bloody hell.
I mean, it just shows you the total ineptitude of symbology here, where it's just like, oh, we have to show Lady Liberty literally dying. I mean, that's literally the kind of like unsubtle level that these guys are at. There's literally like a little world falling off. But beneath it, again, it's like the medievals are just so much more advanced in terms of like laying out all like the numerology and the use of color and symbology here. This is just so obvious and so cringe.
It's so confused as well, though, because it's almost like they've got the MAGA women as degenerates in some way.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, anyway, let's carry on. Let's go to the next part. War in heaven now.
This is great. This is a brilliant.
The war in heaven. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. So this is the war in heaven now. So
what's interesting about this is that it's obviously, this is mentioned in the Old Testament as well, and obviously this has happened in the past, because obviously the devil came down, and the devil was on the earth to tempt Eve. So the Revelations isn't a chronological retelling of what is going to happen. There's things that are in the past, there's things in the future that are happening now, all in this very strange order. So again, don't read it chronologically. One thing I really love about this is the use of the accuser for Satan, because again, that's one of his lesser known names that I really like. And again, I think that works really well with today's modern SJWs being similar, you know,
being the accusers,
exactly. Yeah. So I quite like that. But so the war in heaven, and obviously, like, so this is basically, interestingly, God doesn't fight in this. It's just Michael and the angels. So try and look out for Michael.
Okay, so let's have a look. Okay, is this?
So I start off with this one. This is actually a Blake one, actually. And this is, again, Blake sort of, he actually uses Milton as his guide for this. So in Paradise Lost, this is Satan rousing the rebel angels here. So this is Lucifer, who's depicted as, again, he's kind of like this light figure. He is the morning star. And again, he's got this kind of classical pose, and you've got all of these kind of desolate rebel angels around, and he's trying to rouse them up to fight against God. And they're kind of sad, because if you've ever read Milton, they sort of know they're going to fail, but they just do it anyway.
Yeah, they're up against it. Very, very interesting.
This is going to prelude to the main main war.
But Blake, of course, had the one of the most famous pieces of criticism ever of Paradise Lost, where he said the Milton was of the devil's party, he just didn't know it.
Bear in mind that the devil's that's not necessarily a bad thing for him. Like if you look at his Proverbs of Heaven and Hell, or the Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and the Proverbs of Hell, it's not entirely clear that he inverts a number of things, and he definitely, from a conventional perspective, is a heretic. So you can never tell with Blake.
But there's also another way of reading it, which is to say that because Milton and friends were kind of associated with the Enlightenment, that without even knowing it, they were on the same side of, like, they had put the cogs of the wheels of, towards modernity churning without even knowing it. There's another way of reading it, I guess. But that is not the way, of course, that modern scholarship or even conventional scholarship has taken that quotation. Let's carry on. Because unironically want to make Satan a hero, which should tell you a lot about literary scholarship. So let's carry on.
So now we come to the actual war, and we're starting off with Hieronymus Bosch. So again, one of those kind of Flemish primitives, drawing in 1500. And this is like after the angels have been cast down to earth. Now, Bosch is famous for his kind of horrific hellscapes and desolate landscapes, but this is one of his lesser known works where he's working to a real tight set of colors, the kind of oranges, blacks and yellow, which is a classic scheme. And you've got these twisted angel creatures fallen to earth. And there's kind of like a desolate nature to this kind of, you can see the angels at the top there kind of descending down from the heavens onto earth, kind of lizard creatures and other malformed beings. But there's something kind of just so depressing about it. And
this is almost like Dali-esque, this thing. I mean, what the is this? Just like a head of a man on like some frog body?
Again, like Bosch is famous for the for these kind of horrific half man, half animal creatures, and we'll see more of that in a bit as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Clearly has issues with tadpoles.
these guys take a lot from the natural world. This is the Renaissance. There's some interesting thought about the kind of rise of the kind of cabinet of curiosity, and also natural philosophy as well becoming increasingly important. So the cabinet of curiosity is kind of like a small cabinet in the back rooms of traders, and they would collect things from the New World and from various travels. Some coral, a snail shell, a crustacean that they found, all of these kind of interesting creatures. And again, if you kind of break down where do these guys get the forms from, well, again, that does look a bit like a crustacean with a man's head at the bottom of it, basically. So it's kind of like a sign of this interest and discovery of the natural world, basically.
And the perversity of all classes and orders being mixed and muddled.
To continue with my cursed Gen X references, has anybody ever seen The Fly 2? Not the famous.
No, yeah, I saw the first one.
Yeah, not the one with Jeff Goldblum, the sequel. That has got a lot of horrific hybrid creatures in it. And you just feel like what are you? And it's actually like, there's a bit of it at the end of The Fly, actually, where, when it goes wrong and he kind of merges with the fly and the machine. So he's like hard, like one third machine, one third fly, one third man. But anyway, The Fly 2 has got more of these.
You've got it with, what is it, the 1980s, The Thing with Kurt Russell. There's some of this too.
Yeah, and The Thing as well.
Yeah.
All right, so let's carry on. But I always find it quite tragic, you have to feel sorry for kind of such a malformed, like if you were that, like part of you has to go, pity for God's sake,
In search of a pronoun, yeah.
Yeah, so let's carry on.
So there's another juror here. Again, he's focusing more on the kind of heroic angels here. So you can see Michael here with the lance, but lancing everyone. You've got this kind of band of angels kicking out the rebel angels here. But again, the emphasis is very much on this kind of heroic element here. I'm not that impressed by the demons here. They don't look as grotesque as in Bosch, in my opinion. And then you've got the kind of earth below. But it's not my favourite of the juror selection, personally. But
kind of a Weasley snake-like demons, in a way. Some are like kind of a goat's head there, I think. Okay. So these are the goodies. Okay, yep. Let's carry on.
So it's interesting, again, if, you know, the physiognomy of that, actually, all the good angels look good, and then all of the demons look horrific.
Yes, and I think that's very natural. I've seen this increasing. They've started talking now. Speaking of the demons in our own time, they've started talking now about looks-based discrimination, right? They've started talking. I can't remember the word they've got for it, but they've started talking about taking a stand against looks-based discrimination. That is discrimination against unattractive people, basically. When I was writing Foundations of Rhetoric, I found all sorts of stats about, being attractive basically like doubles your earning potential, doubles your compensation if you win a court case, it halved your jail time if you're a criminal, just because you're good looking. And in fact, if the defendant is better looking than the accuser, it will work that way, and if it's the other way around, it will work the other way around. And this is like a very, very hard reveal preference that people have. So I think they'd be very hard pressed to try to indoctrinate that out of people or to use lawfare, on that front. And if they start doing that, we're in the realm of facial justice. Then
and we're also in the realm where they've set themselves against beauty itself. It's just preposterous, preposterous utopian nonsense. The hell mouth gapes for these fools.
So it's just interesting, though, how hardwired these things are, even, all throughout history. Because I really do believe that the forces we're up against are demonic and evil at this point, like beyond any political considerations. I do think it has become a spiritual battle against the forces of Satan itself. It's just they're manifesting themselves in a very strange way. Okay, so let's have a look at what's going on here then.
So this is a guy called Flans Floris. So again, he's only like less than 100 years between Hieronymus Bosch. He's a Dutch guy, but again, this is kind of classicism from Italy and kind of pioneered by Raphael and the Florentine school coming to the north again. What I like about this is that you have got that kind of those kind of classical forms. So you can see again the angels. There is a kind of the demons have a beauty to them, but when you zoom in and see that they are totally disfigured. My favourite character is on the right hand side. He's got the head of a boar and he has the genitalia of an eagle.
Boar face, eagle dick.
And you know what's interesting here is whenever a style goes north, you see it with Van Eyck or whatever, with its glosses, early Nederlandish painting, it somehow comes into focus. I don't know what it is, but Northwest Europeans, when they paint things, they just want it to be sharp. It's like the Mediterranean is the land of the blur. And the Northwest is the land of something that's actually in focus. I don't know. There are probably many exceptions to that, but it strikes me as a theme.
There's definitely
this creature down here.
A good point. Yeah, no. So I quite like these demons. So it's that combination of kind of like beauty, which has been like twisted and fallen. So like Bosch is like horrifically grotesque. Like while Floris is and you can see that there's the red dragon as well, which hasn't been depicted yet. He's this kind of like quite skinny Weasley beast. Now, interesting, obviously the dragon quite famously has I think it's nine heads. I forget the number. And also importantly, the heads have horns on. Can we get a zoom in on one of the heads? And some of so I think there's
is that a head there?
Yes, and they've got a certain number of horns in, and some of them have crowns on as well. And that's going to become super important when we see the beast later as well. So that's the red dragon across there.
Now, I'm just thinking of the most cursed Gen X reference I can make for this. And I've already referenced Thundercats once. Do you remember Vulture Man from Thundercats? I mean, this is a bit Vulture Man. This is a bit Beast Man here. But also in the Batman comics, isn't there the Cat Men as well? They look a bit like this. So, I reckon there's a long tail on these. I mean, you know, we joke, but these things must be kind of in the cultural ether, even if they're unbeknownst to the artists themselves. Mm. That these ideas kind of then kind of reform themselves in low culture down the line. You know.
Yeah, probably. Like again, you got to. What's the saying in Latin? Nothing comes from nothing. Nulla.
Yes. Nulla. Nothing comes from nothing. Come again. All right. So let's carry on.
Go on two first, because I actually got the wrong order for this. Sorry. If you could go on two pictures first. These are just some zoom ins, but this is Bruegel's famous depiction of the rebel full of the rebel angels. Now this is again is one of my favorite depictions of this. This is kind of done in that kind of Boschian nightmare creatures as the kind of demons. But interestingly here, even the angels are these kind of lank, long-armed, freakish creatures as well. So basically there is a bit, I don't know if you can look at the top first. If you look at the very top, you can see that kind of moon-like area. That is heaven, and you've got this kind of column or a large procession of demons which are being cast down and sort of had their horns trumpeted at and being stabbed at by angels as they descend down into heaven. So this is kind of like a column of demons. Now all the angels are again dressed in robes, they've got their kind of wings, and at the center is Michael. If you scroll down a little bit, he's got his full suit of armor. Just look how lanky he is.
This is Michael.
Yeah, he's again.
Old armor plus 10. Yeah.
He's he looks very freaky, But even more freakish are again the creatures here. And again, you can literally spend days looking through all of the references.
What the hell is that? What is that? It's kind of...
Well, that's like a traditional peasant's hat, but then they've got like a knife stuck in the middle of it, and then again it's like this malformed pig-like creature. But I quite like, again, on the right hand side you've got again this like a frog opening itself up. If you scroll down, they get a frog opening itself up with its little like eyes inside. Or above it you've got some kind of lobster herald, herald of the demon.
And some of these are, if I remember correctly, particularly with Bruegel, but perhaps with Bosch as well. I think some people have looked into it, but there are aspects of this that refer to sayings, folk sayings. So, for example, the knife through the brim of the hat. I'm not positive about this, but I feel pretty strongly about it, that you can find there's a whole tradition of people picking apart some of the image representations and tying them to particular phrases and expressions. So there's a whole further dimension, I think, in terms of the symbolism or the meaning of the painting.
This is the Jordan Peterson phalanx over here, the lobster army.
Again, can you see the muscle shell there? Yeah, and the langoustine arms and stuff. And again, interestingly, there's lots of references to creatures from the New World as well. So again, this idea of newness, being part of the kind of demonic.
This is bizarre. This really is straight.
Everybody looks like death munching on a soda cracker. Everybody's so skinny.
Is that like a mole creature there? What is that?
Who even knows?
And here in this one creature, you have the entire inspiration for Pokemon. Look at this thing. So there we go.
Interestingly, if you can spot it, there is the red dragon in here as well, and he is actually at the heart of this column. But he's quite hard to see. I think his head pops up in a few places. Maybe if you zoom right in the center near Michael, I think maybe that's where he is.
The red dragon. Okay.
Okay.
Is it that little?
No, I may have to zoom in on my side across there. You need to see it up close. It's in Belgium. I've seen this live, and they've actually got this kind of interactive display where you can zoom into like mega detail on everywhere. But just trust me, hidden there somewhere. Okay. If you go to the frog at the bottom. The frog opening itself up.
Yeah.
Can you see there's an animal with a crown on it? To the right.
Bear.
There you go. Yeah. So there's
a head. Very
so again,
oh,
so
that's
again,
that dog. That's a fuzzy dog worm from Neverending Story. How personal yes. reference is that?
High five, Semi Gog. We're getting in on the Gen X dire action. I love that. It is very Neverending Story. That's right. Oh, man. So when was this painted? This painting,
Pharaoh? 1562. Yeah,
this is wild. Never seen this before. It's quite something. Yeah. This one. Okay.
If you ever go to Brussels, check this out.
Wow. Okay. Shall we move on? It's a really good one. I could probably spend the entire stream on this. Just this. okay. I want to know what that is. That evil mole minion or something. All right, let's carry on.
Okay. Now something totally different, but also I think this is one of my favorite pictures that we're going to look at today, and this is from Peter Paul Rubens. So again, he's part of this kind of the Southern Italian neoclassicism that's coming from the South, but he's obviously another Dutch painter. And Rubens is famous for depicting the kind of fleshy forms of man. You know, he loves... let's just say large breasted and ample buttocked women. And it's all about the flesh, about the kind of curves, this kind of classicism, but this is a very warped version of that. I don't know if you can scroll to the top a second, eh?
I think I've seen this. You said it's Ruby. I think I've seen this in
So again, if you start at the top left there, you can see again Michael with his shields casting people out. And what you'll see is as we go further down, people as the angels descend from heaven, they become more and more twisted. And you can see they start to pull each other down as well. So there's this kind of horrific. Yeah. If you look, zoom in on that picture there, that kind of the winged one, it's literally pulling the face of the other demons down. So again, it's this lack of unitedness. They're trying to all claw each other down. There's another brilliant little vignette. If you look on the left in the middle, where there was a trio of exceedingly rotund people, which is quite funny. So if you further down, there we go.
Oh, on the left here.
The trio of fatties. And again, these guys would be like considered to be morbidly obese back in those days. You know, this would be unheard of or whatever, all very, very rarely seen. But again, just the slovenliness. And then as we reach the bottom pits, you have these kind of worst creatures, and they're all fighting against each other, tearing each other, showing the kind of anger, the hatred and despair from these creatures.
This is the best depiction of 2021 I've ever seen. It's literally now, isn't it? This is us here. You know, modern world's trying to drag us down into this depravity, and if only we'd listen to Mary Whitehouse. Okay.
If you scroll up a bit, you can see the red dragon as well. Again, he's sort of subtly hidden as that creature there.
There he is.
Yeah.
Why is the red dragon so sly? He's very.
I mean, that's the nature of Satan, isn't he? He's always lurking in the background,
very hidden and sneaky.
Yeah.
I'd love to see the stats on this shield. It'd be a very good shield. All right, let's carry on. I reckon Michael's got like some of the best gear ever.
Again, he's always depicted crushing Satan, and again, he's going to be hit by all of the anti-colonial rhetoric, because often the devil is depicted as a black creature. Do you remember they were talking about this the other day? It was on the Night of the Garter. They had Michael crushing Satan. And as Satan, as like the kind of black devil, basically, not as a black person, but a devil who has the skin, like a skin color that's black. So again, a lot of anti-colonial guys are out to get him.
To get Saint Michael. I mean, I would say there's an argument to say Saint Michael is the top ranking general of all time, isn't he? I mean, he's literally the general of God's army.
Yeah, he's up there. There's obviously Gabriel and Raphael as well. But
Raphael and Gabriel, yeah.
Yeah.
They're big. All right. So let's carry on.
So this is something a little bit different that I put in. So again, this is from roughly the 1700s, from an unknown Nepalese artist, not from Nepal, but from Naples. And again, this is the Fall of the Angels, but in a sculptural format. So this is one big block of marble. And then if you zoom in, you can see all the kind of angels being carved out. And it's just very unique. We haven't seen any sculpture.
Wow. Good detail on this.
Exactly. But I imagine just like, not chipping one of the arms off and having to start again, basically. But
my gosh, it's just horrific. This scene, isn't it? Like just the whole idea of it being torn down, and there's the Hellmouth. So greedy, never gets full. okay, so let's continue. And here's another one.
So now we're kind of getting, this is the 19th century. So this is from John Martin, and John Martin's famous for his kind of romantic apocalyptic scenes. He does this kind of big, like judgment of the world scene. So it's a little bit different. It's less about the angels falling. Like you can see a couple of them there. There's not that many, but it's about, you know, the heavens above, and that kind of crack of light in the top right hand side, and the dark chasm of earth that they're being held down to. And again, even one of the angels is being crushed to death, or like being crushed down by that boulder. So Martin's all about the landscape, the power of the kind of sublime power of the ravine and the mountain. So again, like he's approached it very differently to everyone else we've seen.
Yeah, so it's much more about the kind of atmosphere and the setting of the place, and yeah, the wonder of this kind of ravine, I guess you'd call it, or cavern or whatever. Okay. Yeah. All right, let's carry on.
This is something a little bit different. This is from Gustave Doré again, the guy who did the Death on a Pale Horse. Again, just what's weird about this is just the kind of color scheme. Again, I'm not sure whether this is a copper plate, which has been, so this is kind of like the reverse of a print. But again, you can kind of see heaven at the top, and then the angels casting down this kind of column of demonic creatures. But the effect, again, I'm not sure whether this is a copper plate or he intended to have it like this, but the colors give it that kind of ethereal, just kind of floating into nothing feeling. And again, if you kind of zoom in, you can see like the occasional arm sticking out or body being kind of tortured. So again, on the face of it, it's this very kind of beautiful swirling painting, but there's this kind of darkness to it at the same time.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. Yeah. Don't know why this particular scene, however it's depicted, is always horrific, I think. Because I hate people, right? So the idea of being in a crowd, even a normal crowd, is something I don't like typically. I remember I went to New Year's in London once. Have you ever done that, Pharaoh? When you do the New Year's Eve? And it's just such a swirling mass of humanity. I hate it. getting back on the bloody, trying to get back on the tube after seeing the fireworks on New Year's Eve it's a nightmare. And this is like that kind of times a million, basically, where you've actively got people trying to drag you down into the Hellmouth. Let's carry on.
Maybe everybody needs like a special sort of Latin or a Greek title. You know, it can be a De Pictor, it could be A.M. Historicus, it could be Pharaoh Arbiter, and it could be A.A. Misanthropus.
I mean, you called me a misanthrope. I still remember your appearance on Unpopular Opinion, Semiagog, where you were detailing your kind of low-level sadistic villainy in everyday life.
You know? That's sadism, not misanthropy.
Okay, so this is a different style.
So again, this is going to the Russians again. So Venetsov again. So it's in the Byzantine tradition, iconic. So again, you've got Michael depicted as kind of like a Byzantine Roman, and then you've got these kind of almost vampiric demons again. So it's a very different style of creatures here. So again, can you see how they're dressed almost like Romans or like late Romans in that kind of iconic style. Now, what I love is the red dragon here is like almost like a fresco, like we've seen. He's almost like a manuscript dragon. He's very kind of graphic and flat and 2D. But then the demons, if you just zoom into their faces, are just like they look like blood sucking vampire creatures. But also, what I like about it is that everyone's had the demons descending to Earth, which has been completely desolate. Again, that kind of barren Earth. Mm. But if you look at the bottom, you can see a small township and the modern land. And I think it's that kind of reminding that yes, the devils are with us in modernity itself. With Venetsov, I mean, he's kind of this is 1915. So this is the time of the Russian revolution and wars, etc. And he obviously Venetsov was on the side of the whites and the Orthodox religion as well.
These are the commies down here.
Yeah, well, exactly. The communist red. Do you know what I'm saying? I think there's a key point into
that. Well, one of the things I like about this that's kind of different from a lot of the others is you get a lot of the others you had the downward movement pulling, right? Mm. Whereas obviously here the downward movement is from Michael's side, you know, it's like thrusting down. They're being pushed down, cast down, if you want. That's kind of interesting, just the way the movement works here.
And in terms of Michael's gear, of course, you have a +6 flaming sword.
So. Yeah, +6 flaming sword. Yeah, with which does like bonus lightning damage probably as well. Okay, let's carry on. I don't know how much further we're going to be able to get today. As you can hear, AAA is already agitating.
Do you want to draw a line and then we could do the rest another time?
We could continue another time. I mean, what do you reckon, Sammy? We can try this another day.
I think there's also a really interesting dimension of this, which is the idea of what is the place of this imagery and of Revelation in general. You know, which is kind of a theme. Where is this that is depicted, and in what sense is it a shared topography?
Absolutely. Okay, so we'll do a part two on this because I've been kind of enjoying the trip through Revelation here. Just before we get going, Yiz with the Entropy Super Chats says Revelation is metal. And then he's got those two little kind of rock hands, if you can imagine. Yiz, a fellow Gen Xer, of course. In fact, a fellow Gen Xer of Semiagog. She is not. She is older than me, and therefore not of the chosen people of the Xennial generation. She's a true Gen Xer. Hence, super chats like this. I've been into D&D since the 80s, and the magic missile spell has always been described as arrows, spears, or darts of magic force, not stars or energy bursts like we see in games today. Semiagog is right.
Absolutely, so I'm right. And let's just go ahead and say why AA inhabits the distorted world that he does. It's simply because when the first video game people were like, how are we going to animate this and have it be easiest to fly in all directions and not have to have perspective on the arrows? And they're like, let's just make them dots. He for AA, a role-playing game is a video game. That's all.
Yes, the eunuch says, I can see it now. War is struggling against civilization, and then out of nowhere, bam, conquest drops civilization with a steel chair. Crowd goes apeshit. I mean, I reckon conquest would be an unseen assassin, to be honest. He strikes me as the wiliest of the four. So, yes. So there we go. That's the super chats from Yiz in the Entropy. And then just a couple in the main super chats here. Chris Primer says, I hear depictions of hell varied, normally shown as a burning hellhole, but sometimes as a frozen wasteland away from the warmth of God's presence.
Yes, well, that's down to ideas around good and evil. And in the Zoroastrian tradition, you have a good and evil, dark and light as equal forces fighting each other. Now, in the Christian traditions, we don't have that viewpoint. It's more like there's goodness and then the absence of goodness. So, for example, darkness is merely the fact that there's no electrons or of light buzzing around. So there's either light or there isn't any light. And so that's where this idea of hell as being this frozen waste comes from, where you've got this kind of hell. Hell is the absence of God. And that's, I believe in Dante, specifically, they have Satan depicted in a frozen lake, don't they?
Yeah, Cocytus. Yes.
Yes.
But there is the thing of hell of the Middle Eastern world and hell of Northwestern Europe, based upon the harshest of their climates. And so you have hell as a burning, you know, coppery furnace versus the idea of frozen lakes and wastelands and fens and freezing marshes.
Interesting. One thing I would say that in as we kind of approach Judgment Day in the Book of Revelations, they do specifically reference that hell is a burning lake of fire. So I think in my mind, the biblical depiction of the flaming lake of lava or whatever is about right. So
yeah, and of course, you know, yet another well-known song. You probably know the Nirvana version, but it is an older. Thank you. Who did the lake of fire? Was it?
I fell into a burning lake of fire.
Oh, it's Johnny Cash, of course. Yeah, Johnny Cash.
That's Ring of Fire.
That's Ring. Who did Lake of Fire? The I know it was a cut. Was it the Pixies? I don't. It doesn't sound like a Pixies song. Definitely a cover though. That Nirvana version.
Pixies and Meat Puppets? You're definitely sounding Gen X now. I don't know what's going on with
you. I love the Pixies, but the Pixies are great. I remember in our school somebody was into the Pixies and everybody was making fun because they were called Pixies and it sounded like, you know. But then he actually managed to kind of like pixie pill most of the year because everybody made fun of him. And he was like, "Have you heard them?" And then everybody got into the Pixies after that. So he kind of one of the rare examples of a, you know, an attempt at bullying, like backfiring on everybody else. And everybody was into like Surfer Rosa and a few others. Cause they were a little bit before our time, of course, in terms of actually being out. But I mean, you know, Debaser, it's a good song. I like the whole, in fact, I reckon the Pixies are one of the few bands ever where, I didn't know they'd made a comeback. I mean, the classic four original Pixies albums are all five star. I would say maybe only the Smiths. I can't really think of many bands where their entire output is five star.
Just looping back to the stream again, DGS in comments has pointed out some of the lyrics from Debaser. If the devil is six, then God is seven. So
it all comes back. Yeah. So I'm trying to, I can't even think of any other, but I mean, Talking Heads go on. I've got a monster run as well. Like from the first Talking Heads album to, I think they got like six amazing albums in a row. But there's not many bands who have like perfect runs like that. Pixies are one of them though. Let's carry on. Harrison Wade says, beyond the carrot pill is self-sufficiency a virtue? Is the network of Red Tens selling to each other not too independently cringe for you also? No. I mean, I think one of the things, though, is that I wasn't advocating like completely going off the grid in the way that some people, like I was imagining a scenario where you leech off the system for like most of your, you know, and we provide goods and services to each other that aren't currently provided type thing, or that, you know, so.
Not carrots, certainly.
Well, I mean, it's just like, well, you know, if it, of all the things that the system provides or doesn't provide, carrots are the least of our worries, I think. You know, I mean, is it a good use of our resources to think about producing carrots? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'll hear the arguments, but I think beyond a kind of hobby and a LARP, we would be better off, you know, preserving, like a much better use of your time would be book preservation, for example.
Speaking of this, I am working on a counter video to your anti-carrot pill manifesto called the Aesthetics of Carrots. That should be out by next week. So hopefully you'll be able to continue the conversation about it.
Okay.
Cast light upon the troubled waters of his ignorance, Pharaoh.
I thought the conversation was over. I thought I put the final nail in the coffin of the carrot bill. All right. Peter Young II says, so many pagan myths have gods launching a coup against a high god, Olympians against the Titans, Baal against Yam. Only Christianity has the coups fail. It's interesting, isn't it? Yep. Because the circulation of elites is built into the religion, you could say. But in Christianity, nothing can challenge Almighty God, the ultimate gospel, authority.
Gospel of Burnham.
Froggy just says, let's go. B, and then it's blank, and then T, blank, blank, blank. Don't even know what those words would mean. Froggy, you're too esoteric, mate. I don't even know... don't even know what you mean. Okay. So, and that's it for the Super Chats. Kind of a light on Super Chats today, but I suppose it was a more esoteric kind of topic. But I just think it's cool. So I think... I think that next week we may be doing Baldur's Gate. I need to speak to... Time Stealer, but we did have it scheduled in the current Deepest Lore for some reason is the only stream that is like booked like 2 months in advance. I don't know why we do that, but it's way more planned than the other streams. But next week I think we've got Baldur's Gate in, but then how about the week after for you to come back on maybe June the 3rd to finish up on Revelation and Art? What do you reckon? Sound good, Semi-Gog? Can you do that, Dave?
Yeah, you said June 3rd?
June the 3rd, yeah.
And it would be the same outrageously early hour of 10 a.m. for me?
The same 10 a.m. hour, yeah. Morkar's illegitimate son has come in with a late super chat saying, please help me, AA. I want my daddy to come home. I don't know about that. Your daddy turned to darkness a long time ago. Morkar's illegitimate son. So, sorry, I can't help you there. And then... yeah, I mean, maybe after that I'll do another little solo stream next week, and then we'll have to figure out. I've actually run out of. We'll have to get back to the drawing board on the schedule for Deepest Lore.
I've got tons of ideas still. So
yeah, I've just seen Emily Nephilim giving a bit of amazing shilling on Twitter. Emily Nephilim, do you remember her of Copium Dem fame? Well, look at the mug she's got there. Look at the mug. She's got a Now Get Out mug.
Now Get Out.
And you too can have such a mug if you go to the merch store. If you click on the link, it is owned by an evil wizard, but you too can have that Now Get Out mug, as well as the Unpopular Opinions mug, and various other bits and pieces if you go there.
I have both, so I recommend to everyone go ahead and get both. There's a feeling of completeness.
Do you know, Semi-Gog, that you took a picture of your mug with that kind of Turkish knight sword and
that was for you, AA. That was a Persian sword.
Turkish, it was a Persian sword.
Yes. I took another one with a Caucasian kinjal. There are two. Yes.
But for some reason, whenever that comes up when I'm showing Mrs. AA a video of mine or so, when I don't send her every video, but occasionally she watches, she always comments on that, and she's down on it for some reason. She's like, oh, what, why have you put that there? seems violent or whatever. So
violent.
Yeah. So
there's also a pre-Republic Peterson's Meerschaum pipe there with a silver band. Yeah. That was supposed to be English gentleman who'd been abroad. That was
it was a very aesthetic image. That's probably one of the best AA aesthetic images out there right now, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's cool, but you know. Mrs. A, she's always trying to sit. She always claims she's trying to civilize me, and she's got this idea that
it's too oriental.
If I go too much towards my Middle Eastern roots, then
she needs to work on the video games. But not that anybody, asked me. Yeah.
What else? There's another super chat come in. Shadow of Saint Satoshi says, check out Christine Lagarde magic number 7. Christine Lagarde. Isn't that the IMF woman? That's the IMF woman, I believe. Oh, there's a whole stuff. Yeah, you can Google that, because there's all sorts of cryptic, you know, cryptic 7 stuff from Christine Lagarde. I mean, I do see people say symbolism will be their downfall, because it does seem to be embedded all over the place among the kind of globalist elite, doesn't it? I know, Semigog, you pay more attention to that than I do, but is that something you notice, that they're always embedding these little symbols everywhere?
No, I don't ever look to. I mean, it may well be there, but I don't ever look to it there. If it is there, I couldn't care less. The fact is that you can find such things. Somebody was talking about it before. It was a bias. Was it on one of your episodes? Or I can't remember where it was, but someone was just talking about the business. Maybe it was on Twitter. Can't remember. Of when you first notice something, then it seems to appear to you everywhere.
Yeah, confirmation bias. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you just thought that the number 15 would be significant, you know, like there are some people interpreting the Quran who go bonkers over the idea of the number 19, you know, mm-hmm. So if you're suddenly looking for it, you can find it everywhere. Not that it isn't there, but I'd go look in a tradition where you know it's significant, like in the Book of Revelations, you know, mm-hmm. you can find 7s and 12s, but much of it, I'm skeptical of the idea that, you know, the elites are like, let's go tell the proles, you know, that 7 is important.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I once just, you know, just because I always want to give things a chance before I completely write them off, okay? But sometimes I think you should write things off if they're too. And I picked up one of these, just a PDF. I didn't buy it. I just found a PDF of a David Icke book, right? And it was so bad. It was just so bad. 1,000 pages long, and literally just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of David Icke pointing out Saturn in things. He just thinks Saturn is everywhere, and that this is kind of like the mark of the lizard people type thing. It's just like
Saturn as like God/ planet.
Yeah, Saturn, the planet. Yeah, and it's just so like, it's just like, yeah, you could do that with anything though. It's just like, you know, yeah. Yes, of course,
I mean, it's think, so cool, we've got a day of the week named after it, for crying out loud, you know, and Kronos and the myths and yeah.
Yeah, but you know, in a way, the SJWs do this as well. You know, if you go looking for racism, you'll see it everywhere, or sexism, or whatever it is. Of course, you're going to find it if you go looking for it. And historians do this as well. You know, they come at something with a thesis, and then they confirm the thesis by seeing it all over the place. So yeah, I do think people should be careful of that tendency in a way. You know, I don't know why it is. Like the conspiracy guys do it as well. They see JFK everywhere. You ever notice that? Like the obsession with JFK.
Yeah, especially with the latest Alien Man crew and JFK. That's when I was like, I mean, there are plenty of reasons why I should have stepped off that a long time ago. But in particular, the business where it all sort of came back around to JFK, I was like, whoa, we just stepped over a threshold into totally bonkers land.
Yes. All right. Anything you'd like to shell, Semigog, before we get out of here?
No. Let's see. Just with my schedule, I'm doing something a little later this afternoon with White Rabbit, and then tomorrow is the Circassian Day of Mourning after they were conquered by the Russians over a 60-year period, and I will be doing a stream tomorrow on my channel with historian Otto Pohl. So if anyone wants to check that out, otherwise, yeah, nothing to shill except my coming back to follow up on the Revelation stuff with you guys on the 3rd. Thank you.
Yeah, now you did a stream together, didn't you, Pharaoh and Semigog, a few days ago on your channel, Semigog, the Theater of Certainty?
What was that all about? With Apostolic Majesty as well, yes. That, I think, turned out excellent. Pharaoh is the art and culture mentat. And AM is the history mentat. So they were just sort of the perfect guests. I had very, very little to do with it. The basic idea is that, what was that? The idea came to me when I was watching one of your episodes, and you talked about that guy whose name I've now forgotten again, the sort of consigliere for Putin, who was discussed in the...
Bezmenov or something? I can't remember. Yeah.
No, it wasn't Bezmenov, but it's the guy who was like a deputy minister of whatever, and who was known for creating uncertainty by basically fielding opposing groups.
Yeah, it's that guy that's talked about in Adam Curtis.
Yes, it was from the Curtis documentary. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and basically the idea was that he created uncertainty on all sides, thereby sort of leaving everyone on a foundation of shifting sand, and you know, unable to take positions or to know whether they'd been infiltrated or to know if something was legitimate or not. You know, so you can see the themes of us talking about chills or glow in the dark. You know, so we've seen that. Interpenetrates, suffuses everything around us, that uncertainty. And so the idea came to me, what was going on with cultures when they attempted to create certainty, when they wanted to show the great chain of being, when they wanted to establish hierarchy and inculcate it in the population? And I said, Pharaoh, AM, you guys want to come on and talk about that? And they did an excellent job.
Do you know what I think I'm going to do, Semi-Gog? I think I'm going to get one of my H-Up Majestic cigars later on. I'm going to sit down for 2 hours, listen to that scream, and smoke one of my cigars. I think that sounds like a fantastic use of my time, so I'll be doing that. Pharaoh, anything you'd like to show before we get out of here?
Just Foundations podcast is continuing next week, and just subscribe to my personal channel as well. We've been going through the art of the mid-century authoritarian groups. So I think next
one. Art of Darkness.
Yes,
you absolute edgelord, you, Pharaoh.
At the beginning of each episode, we have to say how much we love communism at the beginning to make sure that we pass the censors.
That series is really good. I've caught the first two. It's excellent, especially the fascist one.
I'm coming. You can hear that. All right, and I will just say obviously the event. I remind you about that again. Purchase the Trivium, Foundations of Rhetoric, Logic, Economics, etc., Algebra, all still available. Also, check out the review of Foundations of Economics on Lotus Eaters that aired. Was that earlier this week or last week?
Yeah, I saw that come up. That was good. Yeah,
That was that's an interesting one. If you're still in any doubts, those two guys both did it, and I could tell they did it because they were engaging with. Questions of epistemology and statistics versus logic and all this sort of stuff. All right, thank you very much, everyone. Now get out.